It's not actually a law, that supply-demand thing. More like a strongly enforced principle of the market. What do you suppose happens, though, in a pandemic economy, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 12th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. From the good people at the Department of Labor this morning came the latest indicator of the health of this economy. After four straight months of increases, consumer prices, inflation, right? It held steady in October. On the face of it, not so bad in an economy beaten up by this pandemic. But as so often happens with seemingly not so bad news, there is more to it. Those steady prices, even falling prices in some sectors, are telling the story of a recovery losing steam. And as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, it all comes down to supply and demand.
We've seen this supply and demand push-pull on prices right through the pandemic. Remember back in the summer when COVID shut down food processing plants and there were meat shortages? Supply fell and meat prices went up. Now, consumer demand in the economy is weakening and holding prices down. With COVID surging, consumers don't want to go out and spend money. And they may not be able to, says economist Dan North at credit insurer Euler Hermes North America.
Restrictions, they're already coming in some states. It's going to shut down significant parts of the economy like it did before, and it'll make consumption very difficult.
Fear of more job and income losses is also keeping demand down, says Sam Stovall at CFRA Research.
A lot of people are still very worried about overspending. If they do have a job, they're worried about being furloughed with the additional spike in COVID.
We're running into the end of the year. We've got an income cliff coming up for a bunch of people.
That's Brad McMillan at Commonwealth Financial Network. And the income cliff he's referring to is the expiration of federal pandemic unemployment benefits at the end of the year. That adds up to billions a week in payments to more than 13 million Americans. And that's not all that's set to run out.
It's not just a matter of income. It's the prohibition of evictions, foreclosures. In other words, there's a lot of financial damage that isn't showing up on the radar right now, but will start to show up very shortly.
Unless, McMillan says, Congress extends those payments and protections before they expire in December. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
You just heard from Mitchell about the income cliff coming up at the end of the year, right? Still, though, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said again today there is not going to be another big coronavirus relief bill out of Congress, if it happens at all. It's going to be closer to what he was talking about before the election, something near $500 billion, a skinny package, if you will. But with unemployment still high and the virus on the rise, will that skinny bill help the people who need it most? No. It won't. Benga Ajilor is a senior economist at the Center for American Progress. He writes about this kind of thing. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
As you just heard, Senator McConnell said once again today, he does not see the need for a large relief package for this economy. What do you think?
It is very surprising to hear that, given where we are in terms of the pandemic, but also given what happened earlier this year. If you think about what happened in March and April and the CARES Act and how that helped out the economy, we should want more of that given the numbers.
You have said repeatedly, you said it on Twitter the other day, and you've said it in a piece online within the past week or so. Our economic policies are basically geared toward white men. If white men are doing fine, then we get the economic policy that white men need.
That is correct, because if you look at the numbers, you look at what happened in April when we had the peak of unemployment. General unemployment was at 14.7%. White men had an unemployment rate of 12.4%. That's when we saw the CARES Act. That's when we saw all the other things and PPP and a lot of spending to help out this economy. Since then, the unemployment rate for white men has dropped down now to 5.8%. And so you can look at these policymakers and say, oh, well, things are looking good. But if you look at it for other groups, so for example, black men are at 11.5%. So black men have a similar unemployment rate that white men had in April. And then you also even look at what's happening with women. Women last month 865,000 dropped out of the labor force, that they're not even counted in unemployment, and they only got half that back. But if you look only at white men with 5.8% unemployment rate, then you could say, oh, we only need a skinny bill. But white men are not the economy. Everybody's the economy, and we have to focus on that.
Let me ask you one more thing, and I guess it makes sense given the state of play right now. But you wrote the other day, as this pandemic has hit home, lawmakers cannot be counted on to respond to the magnitude of this crisis or any future economic crisis. That is fairly bleak, that we can't count on Washington to fix this economy when it so desperately needs it.
But that's the truth. We've lost a lot of jobs. Unemployment peaked at almost 15%, and we put in $3-4 trillion into the economy. And the thing is, it worked. And instead of putting more money back in, continuing these things like direct checks or expanded UI, which helped people lift, set 8 million people out of poverty, policymakers sat on their hands and let it expire. And all the way through the election, it didn't happen, shocking pretty much everybody.
Yeah.
So, of course, we can't expect policymakers to do that, because in a position where they would have done it, where they should have done it, we didn't see it. So we can't trust them anymore.
Well, so how worried are you then about what is likely to happen in January, assuming Republicans hold the Senate, right? And I get that I'm making some assumptions there, but President Biden will come in with a larger stimulus bill. It will pass the House, and then it will again be subject to Republicans in the Senate who will say, no, we don't need it. And more importantly, we have to start thinking about austerity because we're spending too much money. Then what happens in this recovery?
What I think is going to happen is that we are going to end up with something close to a skinny bill. And then policymakers are going to wipe their hands and then say, okay, well, we're done. And we are not going to have the kind of recovery that's necessary to actually help this economy grow. And we're going to struggle again, and we're going to struggle throughout. And we saw this in the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of money put in, and in 2011, we pulled back. One of the things that happened in 2011 is that white men's unemployment rate was lower than everybody else's. And so we pulled back. We even lost, I think it was 0.5 percentage point of GDP growth throughout that period. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a long, slow recovery that's going to harm not just, communities of color, but even think about rural communities. They're going to be struggling too. And they've been struggling. And that's the big problem.
Benga Adjelor is a senior economist at the Center for American Progress. Thanks for your thoughts. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
A skinny relief bill, more virus in more places, and Wall Street today said, nuh-uh. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Whatever the fate of another relief bill might be, as Benga Adjelor and I were just talking about, back early on in this thing, Congress and the White House weren't messing around. Trillions in spending, the PPP programs we've been reporting on, those $1,200 relief checks and extra unemployment benefits as well. Also, as part of the CARES Act, Congress said that people could take money out of their retirement accounts, up to $100,000, with no penalty. But as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports, turns out not that many people have dipped into their retirement so far.
Alyssa Wright had only been saving for retirement for about a year before the pandemic hit. And at 32, she already felt behind.
Because I started saving so much later than I feel like a lot of people do.
So the last thing she wanted to do was take money out of that account. But then in March, her husband lost his job as a music teacher. And she says,
living on one income has been kind of drastic for us.
They had run through their savings by August and were having to make decisions like,
do I buy groceries or do I pay my car note?
So she finally decided she just had to do it. Take all the money out of her 401k that she had saved, $10,000. Jeannie Thompson is with Fidelity, a Marketplace underwriter, and she says dipping into retirement savings is a last resort for most people, even right now. Only about 4.5% of people with work-sponsored retirement accounts with Vanguard and Fidelity have done it since the pandemic began.
Most people recognize that their 401k is their primary source of retirement income, and they're not going to tap into it unless they have to.
Thompson says most people who have had to worked in hard-hit industries like manufacturing, retail, and healthcare. Alicia Minnell of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College says there's another reason relatively few people have taken money from their retirement accounts.
The people who have 401k plans aren't the people who've lost their jobs. And so even though the CARES Act made it easy to take money out, most of these people are still employed and have no need to tap their 401k.
The people who've been hit hardest by the pandemic, Black and Latinx workers, women, and those who are low income, are the least likely to have a 401k to tap. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
It's been years now, going on more than a decade, actually, that savings accounts just haven't paid much interest. And during the pandemic, yields have fallen even further. Bankrate.com says high-yield savings accounts were paying 2.5% interest last year, on average, that is. They are now paying less than 1% today. Even as low as those rates are, though, people in this pandemic economy are still stashing money away. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
Banks aren't paying much interest to savers because they can't charge much interest to borrowers. The Federal Reserve is keeping interest rates near zero, and mortgage rates are near record lows.
We've had to drop our yields on savings rates significantly to adjust to the new normal.
Peter Alden is the CEO of Bay State Savings Bank in Massachusetts. This year, the bank lowered rates by almost 0.5% on average across its accounts.
We brought down our money market rates, our savings account rates, CD rates, same thing. We've had to cut those down as well.
Even so, Alden says bank deposits have been rising this year. Greg McBride is chief financial analyst at Bankrate.com. He says when the pandemic started, people were worried about the economy and wanted to make sure their money was safe.
People were worried more about the return of their money than the return on their money.
And those deposits have continued to grow. They're now sitting at record highs. Economist Teresa Ghilarducci at the New School in New York says today's savers are likely higher income households, people who kept their jobs during the pandemic and have fewer things to spend their money on.
And they're saving money on not going on European vacations, going out to dinner, or riding the train or taking their car in to work.
Even though interest rates are low, Ghilarducci says all those savings aren't likely to leave people's bank accounts anytime soon. She says what's more likely over time?
That money will go to more foreign goods and services, and it will be socked away in financial accounts.
And in the meantime, all those deposits are money that's not flowing into the American economy. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Three words, people, for your business and economic news needs early in the morning. Marketplace Morning Report with David Brancaccio and the gang that gets out of bed too early. Check it out. Coming up.
It was fun, but kind of like distracting because my sister would always come in the room and distract me.
Yeah, siblings will do that to you. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is down 317 today, 1%, 29,080. The NASDAQ down 76 points, 0.6%, 11,709. The S&P 500 down 35 points, 1%, 35.37 there. Some context on Justin's piece on interest rate and savings. Americans saved 14.3% of their personal disposable income in September. In September of last year, that rate just 7.3%. Did start to tick back up in March, maybe another explanation for the weak demand that Mitchell was telling us about. Back in April, though, did hit more than a third of personal income, 33-something%. The effect of those $1,200 checks from the feds is left as an exercise for you, the listener, to ponder. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury down to 0.88%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We heard from Mitchell at the top of the program about inflation and consumer prices. The flip side of that, of course, is consumer spending, which is still happening, just in case you were wondering. But for a whole lot of reasons, it looks different, that spending does, than it used to. So we got back on the phone with some of our regulars who told us what they've been noticing when they go to the store and what they are shopping for.
Hi, my name is Kaya Price Dennis. I'm calling from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I have noticed that food prices have gone down and gas prices have gone down here in Pittsburgh. People are a tad bit happier because we are able to get out and do more things, but COVID is on the rise again in Allegheny County. I'm preparing to go back to school in person this coming Monday, so we're trying to get back to normal, but we still have a part of the population who is pushing back with wearing masks. Other than that, we're hanging in here.
Hi, this is Sudipto Chatterjee from the San Francisco Bay Area. So I have finally accepted that I have to work from home for a while. Also, I needed a better desk to be able to use my desktop machine and a laptop and a few other devices. The ones I did like were often out of stock or not available in the local store, and I had resorted to looking at customer reviews. Finally, I found this Living Spaces store in Houston, Texas, who had video appointments at their warehouse. A very helpful customer service rep gave us a virtual tour of all the desks in the warehouse, opened drawers for us, walked around and showed us a desk from different angles until my wife and I were satisfied, and I got the perfect desk to work from home within a few days delivered.
This is Ellen Murphy from Mission Hills, Kansas. I'm celebrating the transition from election to apple season by making a crisp consisting of several varieties and covered with a crunchy pecan topping. Apples are on sale, they're fresh and plentiful, and even though the pandemic and politics continue, and there won't be traditional family celebrations to look forward to in the coming months, there will be apples all winter.
Hello, this is David in Denver, Colorado. Well, here in Denver, we've noticed that meat is significantly more expensive than it used to be. We have a particular butcher that we go to, and the prices have gone up a lot, but we still go there to get our meat. Bars and restaurants are much, much more expensive as well. We understand why. They don't have anywhere near as much business as they used to, so they need to raise their prices. We get that, but we are saving money by not going out as much, but we are spending more money at the liquor store.
Yeah, that was Kaya Price Dennis in Pittsburgh, Sudipta Chatterjee in San Francisco. Ellen Murphy was in Mission Hills, Kansas. David Romer in Denver. Virtual school is hard enough for any family, right? For kids who are homeless or have parents who can't stay home with them during the day, it can be all but impossible. Baltimore has opened 15 student learning centers, about 1,000 students, K through 5th grade, who are struggling with remote learning so that they can log into their virtual classrooms in a school setting. As Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, with districts around the country looking to bring more kids back for in-person learning, this is one way that schools are trying to reach the most vulnerable kids safely.
Walking into John Rura Elementary Middle School in Southeast Baltimore, the first thing I notice after clearing the routine temperature check is how quiet it is. On a normal school day, there'd be around 850 students inside the massive brick building, reciting times tables and chatting in the hallways. Today,
we have a total of 65 students.
Catherine Drayton Barber is an administrator for the Student Learning Center, now located at the school. Many of the kids at the center come from low-income immigrant families and have parents who are essential workers.
Students who don't have the luxury of having access to internet, computer access, a parent who's in the home at all times.
Here they have Wi-Fi and laptops and a safe place to be from 8 to 4 where they can get breakfast and lunch and support. The classroom staff aren't teachers, they're district employees whose jobs got sidelined during the pandemic. Bus aides and hall monitors. J. Jessica Hankin is normally a coordinator for early childhood special ed programs. She'd been working from home for months when she got the call in late September to come help run the center.
And I kept on thinking, well, I just don't know if city schools, which before COVID struggled sometimes to keep soap in bathrooms, would be able to keep us safe.
There have been a couple COVID scares, but so far no positive cases, which Hankin says is significant given the surrounding zip code has the highest infection rate in the city.
So I think it does speak volumes to the fact that people are taking it very seriously when they're here, students and staff alike.
Inside the kindergarten classroom, students sit spaced apart with clear plastic shields surrounding their desks. They're all wearing masks. Three air purifiers run constantly. The kids are logged into their individual online classes, with their teachers working remotely. Janelle Anderson helps keep the wiggly 5 and 6-year-olds on track as a proctor, a far cry from her regular job as a high school hall monitor.
Yeah. The total opposite of what I'm used to.
At the moment, one student is doing a feelings check-in on her laptop, looking at pictures showing different emotions. Another has brought his Easter basket for virtual show and tell. Then Anderson takes a group of girls to use the bathroom, one at a time.
It's just hard to keep them focused
and come out.
Doing their work.
Vanessa, come out.
Okay. Go ahead then, sweetie.
A lot of her job will sound familiar to anyone managing remote learning right now, just times 15.
Sometimes the links won't work, or sometimes they'll work one day, then the next day they won't. Laptop's dying.
Earlier this week, all of the learning centers had to send everyone home early when the internet went out. When I visited, Christian Munoz Aguilar's fifth grade class was learning about the election.
To vote, you have to be 18 or higher. You have to be born here to be a president.
Christian's mom works as a janitor, and when school shut down in the spring, she still had to go to work. Christian had to help take care of his 4 siblings.
It was fun, but kind of like distracting because my sister would always come in the room and distract me.
Here, he can concentrate, and he's made some friends from other schools. There's lunch at big round tables and after-school activities. Again, administrator Catherine Drayton Barber.
It's a taste of normalcy. It's a taste of, okay, I have my academic day, and I have my after-school program. Yep. And you can hear the laughter.
So far, only about 1,000 students are getting this taste of normal out of more than 80,000 in the district. More will start up next week, though the city had to scale back its reopening plan amid rising infection rates. Administrators say if there's another shutdown, this time students here will be better prepared to keep learning at home. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, the show's only a half an hour, right? So we got to pick and choose which story gets how much time, and we figured inflation and its discontents was our lead today. But I don't want to go without pointing out that today is Thursday, which means it is also first-time claims for unemployment benefits day. 709,000 people lost their jobs in the week ended Saturday and asked for help. That is lower, yes, than last week and generally trending lower over the past couple of months. Still, triple or more what the weekly number was before the pandemic. Overall, should you be curious, 21 million people are getting some kind of government unemployment assistance right now. Again, the before the pandemic number, about 1.5 million people. All right, we got to go, but not before you get your Thursday moment of economic context. And it's going to clang a little bit with that unemployment item I just did. Some cognitive dissonance coming. A report from a big investment firm today, Apollo Global, that was out this morning, said the total value of all the world's stock markets is now at an all-time high of $95 trillion. No, the stock market is not the economy, not even globally, but that seemingly ridiculous valuation is about a couple of things. Really, really low central bank interest rates worldwide, hopes about a vaccine sooner rather than later, and the top line of that K-shaped recovery, right? It looks really good at the corporate and upper income levels. Way less good below. Amir Bibawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.